For over 50 years, they redefined rock. The spirit lives on.
Monday warrior, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean pride.
Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson. Rush. Live 50-something tour. Sign up for pre-sale access at Ticketmaster. Legends don't stop. They evolve. Rush. This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft is traveling and kindly agreed to speak of his presence in Yerevan, Armenia. This is the capital of a former Soviet state in the South Caucasus, been in the news over the years because of a conflict with Azerbaijan, a former Soviet state that is contiguous over a part of both countries. Both countries are claiming the same territory called Nagorno-Karabakh if you're in Baku. It has a different name if you're in Yerevan. That conflict ended, to my understanding, in late 2020. Since then, there have been efforts by Russia, by Turkey, by Azerbaijan, certainly by Armenia, to resolve the conflict. That has not happened. However, Yerevan, after the beginning of the Ukraine war, has become a refuge, a sanctuary, a discovery for many young people fleeing the Russian mobilization and perhaps the war in Ukraine. Anatole, a very good day to you. Before we turn to the Ukraine and the strange headlines about Prigozhin, how is the business in Yerevan? Because the report is a whole lot of young people, especially information technology people, have arrived in Yerevan from Russia or from Ukraine and applied to found their own businesses. Do you see the streets and the restaurants lively? Good day. Good evening to you.
Hello, John. Well, yes, I mean, absolutely. The place is booming. You know, the Armenian economy has grown by 12% this year, on top of 12% last year, above all on the strength of Russians and Russian money coming in. And the thing is, what is encouraging for the Armenians is that a lot of this is Armenian-Russian money, that's to say, you know, Armenians who are citizens of Russia. And whereas a lot of the Russians, of course, will go on, will pass through Armenia on their way to the West or the Gulf or whatever, a lot of the Russian Armenians will stay and found businesses here. So yes, I mean, it's absolutely booming. It, you know, the evenings and the main square and the main shopping streets, they feel like Milan, frankly. But of course, it's very odd. I mean, it feels weird for me because I spent my longest time in Yerevan in the early 90s, you know, the worst period of the war with Azerbaijan, when, you know, Armenia was blockaded, there was no energy, people were cutting down trees for firewood. And I keep sort of looking around me and wondering where I am. But the other thing is, you know, I talked on the phone to somebody in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is now completely surrounded by the Azeris and protected very tenuously by Russian peacekeepers. And he, of course, sounded just like people sounded back in the 1990s. I mean, an element of real desperation and talk of, you know, fighting to the end and then dying. So it's a very strange experience, I have to say.
And the Yerevan intentions right now are unclear. There was a note in May of this year that Moscow, through the offices of the Kremlin, were seeking a negotiation between Baku and Yerevan. There have been meetings also in the United States about the same topic. To your understanding, has that story moved, or is it waiting for some resolution elsewhere, perhaps the Ukraine war?
Well, I think that's just it. I mean, all the external actors want a settlement. But the problem is that the only settlement acceptable to the Azeris is the return, the complete return of Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan. And that would almost certainly mean the end. Not that they'd be killed, but they would leave. of the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians. Now, you know, Russia doesn't want that. It would be a terrible humiliation for Russia. America doesn't want that because it would cause serious trouble, you know, among the Armenian diaspora in America. Turkey doesn't exactly want that because it would lead to a clash with Russia. And just at the moment, Turkey and Russia are very anxious to get on with each other. And so you have a situation where the Azeris are now in the overwhelmingly dominant military position, but they're not pressing things to a conclusion militarily. They're blockading what's left of Nagorno-Karabakh in the hope that this will bring the Armenians there to surrender.
This is an example of the near abroad in conflict many decades after the end of the Soviet Union. Does this offer a small-scale example of what we're seeing in the anxiety in along the former Russian, the Soviet frontier, the Baltics, Poland, certainly the Western Balkans, Ukraine? No, I'm trying to describe Ukraine to myself as an aspect of the end of the Soviet Union and not an entirely new started war.
Well, I mean, yes and no, but in some ways it's a reverse mirror image of Ukraine, because elsewhere people are afraid of Russia. Here in Armenia, they're disappointed that Russia hasn't helped them more. But in general, they're well aware that they depend on Russia for protection. And there's a good deal of awareness that if Russia is defeated again in Ukraine, then Armenian Nagorno-Karabakh will be finished, because the Azeris would not have dared to be so ambitious a few years back, because Russia would have stepped in to stop them. But of course, Russia is now in no position to do that. All its troops are engaged in Ukraine. But you see, whereas most of the countries around Russia fear Russia, some of them, including Armenia, actually depend on Russia.
Yes, we're looking at Yerevan, Armenia, as an aspect of the Ukraine war. Certainly the burgeoning activity, financial activity in Yerevan, are people who have left Russia, perhaps because of the threat of mobilization, perhaps because of the constrictions of the economy, and are prospering. But we need to turn to Ukraine, which is a driver in many people's considerations, I learn. And the news from Ukraine can be wild and out of proportion to what we see or what we understand. But then there's this report that I bring to my own attention when I saw it. And I thought, what? What am I reading? This is NBC reporting. Good for them. Josh Letterman writing from London. A group of former senior U.S. national security officials have held secret talks with prominent Russians believed to be close to the Kremlin, and at least in one case with the country's top diplomat. That would be Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, with the aim of laying the groundwork for potential negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. According to NBC, half a dozen people briefed on the discussion told NBC News, "This is flabbergasting. Anatole, this is what you have been looking for more than a year. This would be great joy in Yerevan, great joy in Kyiv, great joy in all of the anxious NATO states that are now about to meet in Vilnius within days." Do we regard this as fresh news, fresh information, or has something like this been happening for a year and we just didn't know about it?
No, I think this is new. I mean, what's been happening for a year and more is contacts between William Burns, the head of the CIA, and his Russian equivalents, you know, who have been basically trying to keep the conflict within Ukraine within certain bounds and stop it escalating towards nuclear war. But this kind of track two, as it's called, diplomacy, is new. Of course, these aren't serving officials. They're ex-officials. They have no power to decide anything. But the very fact that they're meeting with Lavrov and exchanging information is, in principle, a very good sign. Because obviously, the Biden administration has said, as have certain European governments, that this war has to end in negotiations. And, you know, informal negotiations or talks between non-officials have been, you know, a very common way of preparing the ground for later formal talks, because you've got to explore the other side's, you know, basic positions before you can move towards, you know, any hope of a formal agreement. So, yes, I mean, this is very encouraging, but it's not, you know, it doesn't in itself indicate any sort of imminent agreement.
The inclusion of Richard Haass in the list, we're given names, we're given Richard Haass, the departing president of the Council on Foreign Relations. That's a significant non-governmental official who touches all aspects of the foreign policy enterprise in Washington. And the participation of Lavrov means that it's not secret. It's not backdoor. We all know our Cuban Missile Crisis history. It was journalists used then and people who were part of the Russian embassy in talks in Washington that eventually helped move the story. The fact that NBC was given this also strikes me as significant. Do you sense why now they turn to this? Is this Prigozhin's mutiny? Is this the counteroffensive? Is this the NATO meeting? Would any of those things or altogether have triggered informal secret talks?
Well, the talks, it must be remembered, took place several weeks ago. So, you know, they predated any of this. As to why it was leaked at this particular moment, there is increasing, and we've known this for a long time. I mean, there was pessimism before the Ukrainian offensive in Washington. And now, they could be wrong, of course, but there's a widespread view that the Ukrainians are not going to be able to break through, that the stalemate will continue. And then, of course, you're going to see more and more people in America, in Europe, but also actually in Ukraine itself saying, you know, that there is no point in throwing away more tens of thousands of lives for a victory which we probably will not achieve. So, I mean, what I think these talks are meant to explore is Russia still determined to gain more land and power in Ukraine, or would it settle for what it's got? And Russia, of course, is trying to explore, is America determined to drive Russia out of Ukraine completely, or would the US accept some kind of de facto compromise, a ceasefire, you know, along present battle lines? Because if both sides can agree to that, then you've got the basis not for a final peace settlement, but for a ceasefire. But first, of course, both sides have to explore what the other side's goals and intentions are. And I think that's the kind of thing that this sort of track two diplomacy can explore and, with luck, discover.
I'm speaking to Anatol Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He is in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, and we're reflecting upon how all of these pieces may fit together, a giant jigsaw puzzle called Eurasia, and it's now headed to one particular spot, Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, within bicycling distance of the Belarusian frontier. And when we come back, what should we watch for from the NATO Eagles when they make their statements next week, 11th and 12th? And this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.